All right, so yeah, so we will talk about detection degeneracies in supersymmetry for effective cases.
Okay, thank you so much. Actually, before starting, I'd like to ask your attention for a little announcement on the right-hand board. I'm trying to round up a little party to visit this play, Die Physiker, the physicists, in Stratford this Friday. I think it's nice, you know, it's about us. It's about a bunch of physicists who get into all kinds of developments. It's one of my favorite plays, so I spotted it as being played right here in Stratford this week. So if you'd like to come along, please send me an email. We can arrange a little party. Okay, I hope I got that date right. This day is actually when this was yesterday, but I think May 22nd is right for this Friday. Okay, so my story is about condensed matter phases where supersymmetry plays a role. And before anything else, I'd like to bring up, you know, why we got into this. So why supersymmetry? You know, we're talking electrons. This is not particle physics or beyond the standard model. So here's some of the motivation. There's various reasons, but one of them is, I guess, one that everybody in condensed matter will recognize. You know, suppose you're looking at, say, let's say a 2D lattice, you put on fermions, let's take them without any spin, and you know, you're asking the hard questions. So let's say not a multi-insulator phase, which can be easy to obtain, not, let's say, a very dilute filling, but somewhere in the middle. So particles with strong repulsion, kinetic terms, and you know, a filling that's not very small or very large, what do they do? What kind of quantum phase do they make? You know, this is definitely a hard problem where also numerical methods are hard to find and trust. So one approach to do this in a simplified setting, actually, Zhang and Henley had some on that, is to simply say, as opposed to repulsion, you simply put exclusion. So you say the repulsion really means that the fermions exclude the nearest neighbor sites to be occupied. So this is sort of infinite repulsion on nearest neighbor sites, and then you put kinetic terms. So that's kind of a toy model that was studied by Zhang and Henley, and they looked, for example, at the case where you take a multi-insulator, this would be, you know, a fixed rigid state. You put a few holes and you see what they do. And they had some evidence in their studies for stripe formation in that model. Now, what we then observed at some point is that you can actually build a model with supersymmetry, and I'll come to how we do that, which ends up being of the same type that I just mentioned. So these will be models where fermions sit on a lattice, spinless fermions. They exclude the next nearest neighbor, the nearest neighbor site. They have kinetic terms, and then there's some additional tuning that we do to actually make these things supersymmetric. It turns out if you do that, you get sort of interesting properties. And I put them here. I think these are the two key features, rather generally. So it somehow turns out that if you insist on this supersymmetry, you are imposing a very delicate balance between the kinetic terms and the potential terms, to the point that the system becomes, in a sense, frustrated. So it starts to have multiple ground states for its option. And in many cases, there's actually an exact ground state degeneracy. There's multiple zero-energy ground states of the system. And they're protected by this supersymmetry. So that's interesting and kind of remarkable. And the other thing is that if you put a supersymmetry, you get certain, you know, tools available to get some analytic control over the situation more than, let's say, average. For example, we in many cases, we can actually count these ground states. We can say what kind of properties they have. So you're a bit more powerful than on average if you don't have this symmetry. And of course, this is well known from high energy physics, where, you know, theories with supersymmetry are a bit easily, more easily manipulated than if you don't have that symmetry. So, but you'll see now as we go along how these kind of things actually play out in concrete examples. So here's, you know, this degeneracy business. Let me give you a flavor of that before I go to details. So the simplest model we built is this thing we call the M1 model, where I'll explain why it's called M1 and what MK will be later. If you take this model, you put it on a 1D closed chain, very simple, you find two ground states. So there's already a degeneracy, which is remarkable. If you put it on a square lattice, say, n by n sides, you get a pretty bizarre sequence of ground state degeneracy. So here are some numbers. So this is, you know, 1 by 1, 2 by 2, 3 by 3. So if you do 6 by 6, 14 ground state. If you do 8 by 8, 7 ground state. So there's some crazy frustration going on that gives you these exact numbers. If you do 2D triangular, put the same model, very simple, I'll define it in a second, we have lower bounds for how many ground states those have. And, you know, they explode. as you increase the size of the lattice. So we don't know the numbers of ground states. We do know this lower bound. We know it's exponential. So it's extensive entropy in the ground state manifold in this model, with only very limited tuning that we do. So these are remarkable things. The nature then of these ground states, rather than the number. So if we do it in 1D, we can, you know, control everything. Sorry.
Is
the
exponential in the number of sites or in the
Yeah. In the area, so in the 2D area. Right. So in 1D, you know, we can solve these things and control everything. We find this model to be critical in the simplest case. So it's a 1/3 filled model, critical properties. We can, you know, add some perturbations, but keep the supersymmetry to make it off-critical, to make it staggered, massive, and then we see charge density wave order. And if you go to these 2D cases, we don't know too much. In many cases, we know the numbers of ground states. But if you ask me what kind of properties do they have, what kind of order are they hiding, we don't know too much. So here's, for example, a picture for the 2D square case, 6x6 sides, where, you know, there's a tiling on the left, which I'll mention later where that comes from. And that suggests a certain picture of, you know, particles sort of constrained to these tiles forming some kind of density wave pattern. But we don't know too much because, you know, beyond the counting of these states and a few more things, you know, this is as hard as can be. This is 2D fermions, and we don't control their properties too well. But, you know, we get a few hints from this supersymmetry. Then there's this other model, which is, for today, my most important topic, this thing called MK, where K refers to some kind of clustering that's coming. In that case, if we do a closed chain, we get K plus 1 ground state, so there's more going on there. On open chains, there's no degeneracies. There's either no zero energy ground states or a single one of them. So there we seem to lose this property of degenerate ground states. But then it comes back to us in a sense, and that's sort of the recent results that I'd like to bring up today. It turns out if you put defects or you enrich the model, for example, by taking special boundary conditions, boundary defects or bulk defects, you in a sense recover these multiple ground states. So you get large numbers of extra states that come down in energy in exponential fashion, so e to the minus system size. So you do find back these multiple degenerate states, and there's a nice structure to how they come to you. In particular, if you do these MK models, the systematics of how many states you get and how they're organized really comes from some parafermion structure in a critical CFT that describes these critical phases. So these defects are have a very nice, interesting structure. And in a sense, going to these open systems plus defects gives you a lot of flexibility of playing with these ground state degeneracies and understanding their properties. So this is the recent results together with my student Tessa Fokkema. So my main purpose for today is to actually bring up this part here, but I can't resist the opportunity to say a few more things about these other cases as well, which is some older work, because in a sense, it all hangs together. There's sort of one phenomenon going on that plays out in various detailed situations. So let me start at the beginning. This was introduction. Let me, you know, guide you through how we build these models and how we analyze them. And it's actually, it's amazingly simple. So you can really follow, I think, every line. It all starts by looking at quantum mechanics in a supersymmetric fashion. This goes back, I guess, to Witten, 1980 or so. So there's a few things that you need, and then the whole thing sort of goes by itself. So you get into the situation of supersymmetric quantum mechanics if you have in your, you know, quantum mechanical space of states, two operators that are your supersymmetry charges, Q plus Q minus, they should square to zero. They should, you know, add or take out a fermion. So your fermion number gets increased or decreased by one unit if you add a supercharge. And then if you have these properties here, all the rest is done. So from here, you make a definition that your Hamiltonian is going to be anti-commutator of the two Qs, Q plus Q minus anti-commutator. And if you do that with two lines of algebra, you find that this Hamiltonian commutes with the supercharges. So you have a symmetry built in from the start. And you can do whatever you want to define these Qs. So this is highly flexible. We'll make lots of different definitions. But every time we'll insist on these properties, we'll make a Hamiltonian and we'll start analyzing the what it stands for.
Fermion number conservation is an extra thing, right?
So well, if you insist on this here, it's automatic. So if the Qs lower or increase the fermion number, if you don't do this, you can also do a version which is called, this would be n equals 2 supersymmetry, with a good U1 quantum number, you can also do an n equals one supersymmetry, where you don't have that, which is more like the sort of Majorana version of this thing. This is more the Dirac version. But I'll insist today, you see this NF will be my number of fermions on the lattice. So I'll have that all the time, and I'll put it in all the plots. This NF will be my fermion counting operator. Okay, as soon as you have this, there's a few things you can already conclude from the structure. First of all, your energy is positive because it's like a square of the cubes. All the E larger zero states are paired into doublets. Every time you have one of them, you apply a supercharge and you get another. So these are doublets. Except if the energy of the state is zero, because then both supercharges kill the state. You have zero energy and you have a singlet ground state. Okay, so this is the structure that's imposed on you as soon as supersymmetry is defined in the way that I did this here. And then there's an index, sort of a counting device that's used by Witten to keep track of the number of ground states. This is a magic thing. So if you take the trace of minus one to this fermion number operator, this you can do without, evaluating the Hamiltonian. You simply take your space of states, and you look at so many states with fermion number this or that, and you take this trace here. If this is a non-zero number, it tells you there's a certain number of ground states with zero energy, because all the multiplets, the doublets with non-zero energy always have a state with fermion number f and one is f plus or minus one, so they cancel in the trace. So if this trace is, let's say, 2 or 3 or 5, it gives you a lower bound on the number of ground states. And so, for example, the numbers I gave you for the triangular lattice were written index numbers that we could compute quite easily, and they would give us a lower bound to how many ground states that system would have. Okay. So that's very general, that you can apply in lots of situations. It's been done in nuclear physics and all kinds of contexts. But today I'll build fermion lattice models using this structure as we have it. And my approach will be the following. So this is this first model, this M1 model. I'm going to put fermions on my lattice, no spin. I insist on nearest neighbor exclusion. So I forbid them, I don't want this. This is a configuration that I'll omit from my Hilbert space. So I take this correlated space with no nearest neighbor occupations. And I simply define my Q to be, essentially the sum of the fermion creation operator in all possible places, added over all possible sites. And, I put these 1 minus n projectors to make sure I don't put a fermion in the wrong spot where it has a neighbor which I was going to forbid. Okay, so this operator stays within this constrained space. It's squared to zero, essentially, because these are fermion operators. It adds a fermion, as I insisted on before. So it has all the right features, and I can define now this Hamiltonian to be the anti-commutator. Okay, and since this Q is dressed with these 1 minus n factors, if I anti-commute the two Qs, I get non-trivial terms, where actually fermions start to hop from one side to the next. So in general, this kind of construction gives you kinetic and potential terms combined, but in a very subtle balance between themselves. So this is the original definition we made with Fentley and De Boer 12 years ago. Okay, so if you do this in 1D, that's the easiest example. If you write out the Hamiltonian, you see that what I announced is actually working out. So here is the Hamiltonian in the usual language. You see it's just nearest neighbor hopping, protected by these projections on the two sides. The exclusion is assumed. And then there's one more term, which is actually a next nearest neighbor repulsion of unit strength. Okay, so if particles come two sides away from each other, you pay an energy. If they are farther than that, there's no cost. So this is the only complication as compared to this Henley and Zhang model, if you wish. Okay, so let's practice on a simple case. This is one-dimensional six-side closed chain. So let me illustrate how this stuff works in general on a very simple example. Let's compute this Witten index trace minus one to the NF. So that's just counting on your fingers. Yeah?
I'm trying to understand in what sense this is supersymmetric in the quantum mechanics sense, but it's not like the commutator, anti-commutator of two supercharges is a translation in the lattice.
So if you look carefully, I do have that my time translation, my Hamiltonian, is an anti-commutator.
Yeah.
So in that sense, it's supersymmetric quantum mechanics. But it turns out that, for example, in this 1D case, what comes out is a fully space-time supersymmetry algebra. So you get superconformal symmetry in space-time emerging from this. So it is really space-time supersymmetry.
In a continuum limit?
Yeah, because No, no, but this thing will be critical, so you can take a continuum limit and you find, you know, an actual superconformal field theory with space-time supersymmetry. So there's something magic going on. You build it in on the level of the Hamiltonian, and it emerges as a space-time supersymmetry. Okay, so back to my example. Let's do this. You know, this is really counting on your fingers. So here's what you can do. If you put no particles, there's one state. One particle, there's six ways to put it. Two particles, you have to be careful. You know, they shouldn't be next to each other. So they can be two sites away, that's six states, or three sites away, that's three states. So that's nine in total. Three particles, there's two ways to do that. And that's all. So this width index is, you know, 1 - 6 + 9 - 2. So that's two. It's non-zero. So this tells you that this is an example where there have to be at least two zero energy ground states that are not supersymmetry doublets, but are singlets. Okay, so let's do the spectrum. This is what you get if you work it all out. And you see that indeed, everybody is a doublet at positive energy, as you know, imposed by supersymmetry. But then there's two guys down here which are alone. So they don't form a doublet. They're two separate singlets. And they have to sit at E equals zero sharp because of the whole construction. And now you see how this thing is starting to work for you, because you know, I could predict two equals zero states with no work at all, only counting a Witten index. Okay, and for six sites, that's easy. But if you do it for 600 sites, it's the same story. And I get sort of power from supersymmetry. Yeah?
Is it only generic with the energies and integers?
No, this will be much more complicated. So I'm coming to that in a bit. But everything is kind of difficult, except we control what happens down here at zero energy. Okay, so let me go through this simple thing in 1D for a general length. So here's some results. If you give you do closed chain, three L sites, let's say 600 or whatever, the Witten index is always two, so it's still non-zero, also for big systems. But there's always two ground states, and they happen to sit at filling a third. So there's one third of the particles, the sites is filled. Open chains are different. There's only one or zero of these ground states. And then, you can analyze this thing as much you like. It turns out to be integrable, so there's a beta on that solution. You can map to XXZ and take it from there. You can do numerics, you don't even need DMRG or so. If you do exact normalization, you see quite clearly what's going on here. And you find this thing as defined as I did, it's by itself critical without any further tuning. So it's a critical lattice model. And there's actually a CFT that describes this properly. So that's sort of interesting. This whole thing by itself cranks out a non-trivial SUSY CFT. Yeah.
So usually for fermionic state, you have the bosonic counterpart. You apply Q, you get the bosonic state. And in this case, are you saying the hole is a boson? Or?
It's in a sense that the partner of an occupied site is an empty site, right? Because the Q takes an empty site to a filled site, so it drops a particle on a given site.
And so in 2D, that pole would be a boson? Or is that simple?
I'm not sure. I don't have one particle bands, right? This is really fully interacting stuff. So the only, what I like to say is, I have filled sites and empty sites, and they are the pairs of the supersymmetric doublets.
Because at low energies, you'll get this field theory, which has, I guess, a fermion and a boson. Is it n equal 2?
This is n equals 2 superconformal symmetry, which you can you can organize in various ways. It's not it's not free fields. This will be interacting CFTs, but you'll see as we go. Maybe that will clarify things.
But there's no like UV fixed point, which is like a free boson and a free fermion, and their interaction is close to.
No. So let me show you some details. Maybe you come back to the question if you like. So here's, let's do open chain spectra, because today I'll focus on these open chain situations. So there's a CFT. Which one is it? It's the first minimum model of n equals 2 superconformal field theory. So the n equals 2 is built in. And then it turns out it actually, builds out to a full superconformal symmetry in the field theory sense. So this is C equals unity theory. You can write it using a single scalar field if you like. That's an old construction of Watterson. And then, there's various sectors. Ramon Nevers Schwartz, it turns out, what we need for our boundary conditions, open chain, is the Ramon sectors of the theory. So essentially, we have vertex operators of a boson field that build the CFT. So let's say V sub M. And then it turns out, if you match those CFT modules with our numerical spectra, it turns out this vertex operator charge connects to our fermion number like this here. So you see if the F is roughly L over 3, I'm one third filled, so we are looking at M near zero. So here is how this works. So this is a numerical spectrum. This is, you know, open chain, 21 sites, 6, 7, 8 particles. And you see this is a case where there's actually a zero energy ground state, a single one of them. And then there's all these excitations, this spacing like 1 over L. And now if you put next to that the CFT spectrum that's appropriate for this, it would look like this. So there's this M, the vertex operator charge, that connects to the F like this here. So you can check all that. And you can see that, you know, this matches is quite nice. So already for small size systems like 20 sites, the connection to CFT spectrum is quite spectacular, and you can really understand things quite very nicely. So here's actually what's going on. So if you look at the CFT, at all the sectors that could, you know, come into the story because of having the right boundary conditions. So here's this again, this boson charge. Here is the energy. My lattice operators have energy like this here, so there's a small subtraction. And now you can see what's going on. So if I take a length, which would be 3j minus 1, f equals j, I would have a ground state. So I would have this kind of state, you know, represented in my lattice model. If you add a site to the lattice, you see, you know, you go to 3j, still f equals j, you know, you kind of jump because of this m modification one step to the left. So there's another ground state that you're finding. If you add another site, you go one to the left, there's no ground state. So the lower states are now in a doublet. And you can keep going. But if you add one more extra site, you end up here. And by that time, you know, it pays to add an extra particle. So from here, you can actually apply a supercharge operator to put an extra particle in, brings you back to this sector here. And then you can compare what you've done here. So you very nice to see here that this is a one-third filled system, right? So you add three times a single site, and then you add a particle, and then you're back to the same kind of structure as before doing that. Now, if you like quantum Hall states, this is very suggestive as a comparison. This is precisely what you do in a Laughlin one-third quantum Hall state. Those are also one-third filled quantum states where you can add, you know, single fluxes, which is like adding a one-third charge hole in the famous Laughlin argument. If you do that three times, you can fill the hole with an extra particle, and you're back to where you came from with the gauge transformation. So in a very nice analogy, there's, you know, the extra sites on my chain are like the extra fluxes in a quantum Hall state. So this is some very interesting comparison between my 1D SUSY systems and these 2D quantum Hall systems. And actually, the reason why this is so close is, you know, my CFT, so to say, that organizes my critical behavior is the same that organizes the Laughlin state. If you do the quantum Hall construction using conformal field theory, it will use this exact same CFT to get started. Yeah. Okay. And this is, you know, please keep this in mind because I'll build on this to go to the non-abelian states in a second. Okay, now before I do this MK in one dimension, yes.
So in the 1D CFT, so you have a global U1 and also translation symmetry, and suppose you keep the lattice sports symmetry as an exact symmetry, and how many relevant perturbations at your CFT?
For this one, actually, there's none. So that's also why, you know, without any tuning, we end up in a critical theory. Okay. So we can go off critical here, but then we need to break translation symmetry by doing some staggerings. Uh-huh. But, you know, a bit later, there will be these MK models where I will get number K model of the N equals 2 series, and then I have to tune to become critical. And I can actually go off critical due to a relevant operator that's still supersymmetric. And then it's much more subtle.
And what if you relax the lattice symmetry, if you just keep translation on U1?
I guess, well, then you lose the magic, right?
Do you know how many relevant directions you have around that CFT?
Well, this is a C equals unity. So I guess there's the usual marginal, right? The marginal one that moves you along the C equals unity line, and that's all you have.
But in this last information should
be like... Well, okay, but yeah, sure. I'm not sure if you keep translation symmetry and U1 how much room there is. I don't think there's much else than the one marginal operator.
Is that exactly marginal?
Yeah. But again, it will break my supersymmetry. So in a sense, it gets me out of my space of theories. Of course, that's interesting. You see, these are clearly highly tuned models. And I think one thing you would like to understand from this is, you know, actual systems with, let's say, lots of low-lying states rather than exact equals zero ground states. So if these systems where you stay close to these special tuned supersymmetric points, but you lose the exact degeneracies. Let's say, you know, a Kagame to the spin a half magnet, things like that. Okay, but let's play a bit on this, you know, this MMOM model on the 2D lattices. Since I announced these crazy degeneracy numbers, let me show you a bit more before I go to my MK models. So let's do this with an indexed computation, you know, which is an easy computation, also on the computer. You simply do a transfer matrix and you crank out all the numbers. So actually I asked one of my master students to do this and he came up with this table. I did it first myself, you know, on the back of an envelope, and I started to build a table and I found all these crazy numbers. And then I asked my student, you know, make me a big table. So he made me a big table. And then, you know, that clearly showed these exponential degeneracies. So these ground state numbers grow like crazy, and they're bounded from below by an exponential in n times m, so to say. So, you know, we've called this super frustration, because clearly there's some exact quantum frustration going on here, and it's definitely protected by supersymmetry. So it's a very remarkable thing. And, you know, this particular case is still poorly understood. There have been quite a few follow-up papers. So on the mathematical side, people have tried to nail these numbers, and they haven't gotten beyond, you know, certain boundaries. For example, there are certain limits on where these ground states can sit, for example, what density they have. But we don't know exactly all that information. You know, we've looked at ladders where you take, let's say, 3 times L or something, and then we've partial results on those. But the whole thing is still pretty much a mystery. And for example, this one number, so the ground state entropy per site, which we know is 1 point something, but we don't have it, and it's mathematically it still escapes our analysis. 2D square is another table that Van Eerten made. It's definitely a different table, right? And these actually, I showed you some of the diagonal entries on my earlier slide. But this is highly remarkable ground state degeneracy on the square lattice. It's not exponential in the sense of growing by the number of lattice sides. It turns out to be exponential in the circumference, in the perimeter. I guess that's appropriate for this place. So it goes like exponential in n plus m, if you do n by m on the side. And actually, in this case, we got some help from mathematicians, and we ended up cracking the numbers. So we can actually reproduce these numbers in closed form now. And the first step that in that solution was given by this guy, Jakob Jonsson, who's a mathematician in Stockholm. And he came out of the blue. He had seen our papers and, you know, heard our stories. And he came with a very remarkable result. He says, you know, let me define a different problem from yours, which is to tile the 2D square lattice with these two shapes, area 5, area 4, green and red. And then he proved, you know, using lots of combinatorics, that if you count the number of tilings on let's say, a torus with my boundary conditions, and you subtract the number with even tiles and with odd number of tiles, that is the Witten index, you know, up to a very small correction, plus or minus 2 or 4. So there's a geometric construction counting tilings, which gives precisely our Witten index. So he got this whole table from the tiling. And then when he'd seen that, he said, aha, if this is, you know, if T even minus T odd is the Witten index, then it has to be that T even plus T odd is the number of ground states, right? So that was kind of obvious. And we started to work on that with Lisa Hausen, my PhD student at the time. And we actually proved this result here, which was, you know, quite a piece of art, I think, of Lisa. So we established that the ground state counting for this system is actually the number of tilings plus or minus a very small number. And, you know, from that, you can actually make these tables and get all the numbers. This inspired this little picture that I gave you, where the idea would be that these particles somehow sit in charged density wave patterns that follow these tiling systematics, but we don't know much more than that. We don't know about gaps, we don't know about edge states, we have all kinds of partial results. But again, this is pretty much escaping a systematic understanding so far. And because these have different area, right? So for example, this is 4, that's 5, 4, 5. If you have 20 area total to cover, you could use 5 of those or 4 of those. And so they would actually subtract in the Witten index, and they would add in the number of ground states. So these ground states don't sit at the unique density. There's a certain window between a quarter and a fifth, actually, of densities where ground states happen. So there's also some cancellations in the Witten index as compared to the actual count of ground states.
Is there some intuition behind this connection?
Well, from the mathematical point, yes. So I didn't put this up, but you can actually formulate the problem of finding these zero energy ground states as a cohomology problem, because here there's these two Qs, and the ground states have the unique property that, you know, they're killed by Q plus, let's say, and they're not the Q plus of somebody else. So that's a cohomology statement, and you can use, you know, mathematical machinery to crack the cohomology problem, like spectral sequences and things. So we started on that, and Johnson uses this kind of methods for his analysis, and then he came up with these tilings to summarize his solution of the counting problem in that way. But physically, again, you know, in the beginning I gave this little picture where the particles are essentially like in sort of lambda level. They're cruising on this 2D surface, and they're pretty much occupying the area given by these tiles, which means that it's not uniform, but they're slightly compressed between 4 and 5 area per particle. And so something like this is going on, but we lack, you know, there's been some numerics on small systems, but you can't go beyond 5 by 5 or so because of the usual reasons, and it's still open. Yep.
And you only have this tiling picture for the square lattice.
Yeah, for the triangular, that was the obvious thing to try to do that counting using some other way of tiling, and we couldn't do that. Also, we asked Johnson to take another try at that, and it's still open. You know, there's some partial results again, but not a decent analysis.
So what's the property of the lattice that you need to have to be able to count ground states?
Okay, I didn't put them here, but we actually sort of designed a few lattices where we can do it. For example, in one case, we picked a lattice which has, it's called enneagons, right? Nine gons and triangles in a certain configuration. In that case, the counting problem we could actually map to a dimer covering problem, which was known in literature. But the dimer covering of hexagonal lattices maps to our problem on that crazy lattice. So there we have a number. But that was a sort of contrived example. And in the other cases, it's an open problem. So if you guys have ideas, try your best. Okay?
One other question. So maybe you said this, but in many of these cases where you have the counting down, you actually have a pretty detailed understanding of the wave function too, like the state itself?
No. Now, and you see, it can't be that simple. So, for example, the counting on, let's say, 1D closed chain is almost trivial. But the actual ground states are critical states. So they are, you know, even with the beta ansatz, they're difficult to write down. So there's no easy connection. You know they exist, but you don't have them in closed form. Okay, so let me go back to one dimension, and I bring in this number k, which is actually quite an interesting enrichment of the story, I think. So here's definitions. We relax our condition of forbidding nearest neighbor occupation to say, well, we allow up to k of them next to each other, and then it has to stop. Okay, so this would be, you know, allowed in k equals 2 or more. So this is a bigger space, and it's a less severe constraint. And in a sense, what we're doing, if you do k equals 2, it's like constructing a paired state. And the funny thing is that we can actually go beyond pairing. So if we do k equals 3, we are, in a sense, building states which have a fundamental clustering of fermions built in, which is, you know, quite interesting because you don't usually have that if you follow the usual schemes. So we keep this k as a parameter, and then we do the same trick. So we say, well, let's, you know, create particles within these bounds specified here, and let's make this q. And so you have to be a bit more careful now because there can be different situations. So the particle that you create with the D dagger can, you know, complete a K tuple in various ways. And depending on how that goes, you can put different weights here. So there's some room to play with these lambdas. And in a sense, we allow everything as long as Q squared is still zero, because otherwise we lose the supersymmetry property. So we have quite a rich parameter space of choices for these lambdas. So what we work with, these are in a sense the best choices, it seems, because to give you the clue, these are staggerings. So we give these weights a certain periodicity on the lattice, modulo k plus 2, which is natural. they're integrable, so we can actually do beta ansatz all the way through. And we tune them such that if we take a lambda equal to unity, it's critical as well. So we find this critical point. So we build n equals 2 number k critical models, and we can go away from criticality in a controlled manner, keeping integrability alive. So this is, you know, quite a nice choice. And how to do this was figured out by a number of papers by Hagendorf and Lisa Huis and also Tessa Fokkema. So we've been using this situation. Yeah.
It goes to the opposite way. You don't allow k nearest neighbor to be repulsion on k nearest.
So you want k empty sites in between.
Like the M1, but MK now with repulsion.
Probably it may be dual to what we do in some sense. I'm not sure. Yeah, you know, you can do endless games, and in a sense, this is one that seems to be particularly nice. That's why I bring this one up.
Well, the other one put more constraints, as it were, right, locally, because you're allowing lesser and lesser possibilities. As it were, if you could think of ground state degeneracy as being that the problem is somewhat under constraint, that's why you're able to have satisfying ground state.
So, I mean, there's lots of room to try out different things. And the one you suggest, we never looked at in detail. So, again, you don't want to just, you know, play around. We certainly had reasons to look at this particular case here, because we wanted to go to the number k minimal model. We want to compare to rich Desire states in two dimensions. So this is a particularly nice choice of things.
But is it fair to say that as you increase k, the number of ground states grows?
So it happens. There you go. So on the closed chain, this written index actually goes to k plus 1 now. So it does grow. And there are more choices. And then their filling ends up now k over k plus 2. So we actually, you may recognize these numbers if you're a quantum Hall. These are rich Desire filling fractions of the quantum Hall states. But we find these numbers. So there's like 3 over 5 for k equals 3 and things like that. And there's many more of them. And then if you do field theory for describing the low energy properties, so at criticality, which is our lambda equals unity, this is the number k minimal model of n equals 2 superquantum field theory. So now if you write that in the usual fashion, that's a scalar field for the charge for the U1 plus more stuff, which are ZK parafermions. So this is interesting. We're building in the parafermion structure. We're getting out in a sense, because we're landing on this particular field theory. So somehow this business of having these k tuples and breaking them into pieces by excitations is organized by ZK parafermions. Not so surprisingly, but it comes out very nicely. And then if you move off critical, these are relevant perturbations, and you know you're in this land of, you know, integrable n equals 2 massive field theories. So Vafa, Chakotay, Fenty, and Trilligator, these analyses of quite some time ago, and you can do, for example, Landau-Ginzburg descriptions in superspace. And so these are known theories that we actually could compare to. But the simplest case would be the k equals 2 would be supersymmetric Stein-Gordon theory, but the more general case is you know, found in the literature, and we connect to those quite nicely. Okay, so now let's go to these open chains. Let me try to tell you how these defects can be used to steer into ground state degeneracies in a nice way. So here's again, let's say the M2 case, the CFT spectrum, the Ramon sector modules, which are available as possible states for our ground state, for our numerical spectra. So you need to be in the Ramon sector because these are open chains, and that's how it works. And what you have there is, you know, there's these U1 modules V sub M as before, but now there's, in a sense, an easing factor added to this. So there's a Z2 easing CFT available. So there's psis and sigmas, as you know them, and they are part of the story now. And it's interesting to see how this CFT spaces connect to our open spectra. So here's, just to be sure, these are three SUSY singlets with no partners. And everybody else, you know, is paired up with Q plus and Q minus, which works like this here. So it connects a state like here to a state like that. Okay, so now here's an actual numerical spectrum. So this is 25 sites, open chain. You know, so many particles, we sit near half filling for k equals 2, k over k plus 2 is now a half, and you see what you get. And if you compare now to the CFT available states, you quickly found that you sit over here. So you have to pick the right M. It turns out for even particle occupation, you sit in VM modules, and for odd, you sit in psi times VM modules. So in a sense, the fermions on the lattice now carry, you know, an easing psi field with them, which is, you know, interesting to observe, and there's this Z2 correspondence. So even F means Vm no size or even number of size, and F odd number of size. So that's, you know, the correspondence that you can do. You can play with how long the chain is. But now, if you wish, you know, if you make a little list and you compare secretly to, let's say, the Moore-Reed quantum Hall state, which would be the one that corresponds to this quantum field theory, you have an operator that adds a particle, which is the supercharge. You have the quasi-hole of charge a half, so an extra side, since this thing is half-filled, that's like a half-charged object. But you don't have, you know, let's say, the hero of the Moore-Reed state, the quarter-filled excitation, which is the one with the non-Abelian statistics and the magical properties. So this is not in my story. So these would be the sigma modules of the CFT. And you see, I don't reach them. These are the purple ones. And if you do open chains, you never find them. You never hit those modules. You always sit on psi or unity. So we thought, you know, how can we actually inject these sigma operators into these chains and actually find these quarter charge guys? It turns out what you need to do is put a defect, which we call sigma type, because it will bring in the sigma fields. And what it does is the following. So my definition for the number two model allows pairs of particles next to each other. But, you know, I can, in a selected spot, actually forbid this after all. I can say, you know, in a given location, I put a defect, meaning that I block this configuration on this particular site here. And since I'm blocking a double occupancy, I'm, in a sense, blocking half a site. And since a site is a half-charged excitation, half a site is like a quarter charge. So you can see coming that doing this here is actually going to be like a sigma field in the CFT. And you can check that. So if you now do a spectrum where you put a sigma defect, let's say, on the left hand of your chain, and you repeat the analysis, you find, you know, a different numerical spectrum. And now you actually hit these sigma modules. And you can check that all the degeneracies and all the CFT stuff is precisely reproduced. So that's if you do it on one side. If you do sigmas on both sides, that's the next thing you can try. You get yet another spectrum. And now you see you get ones and psi together at the same particle number. So now you get sort of a doubly dense spectrum. And that's interesting because now you see it's no longer true that for a given F, you get either V or psi V, but you get them both. And if you think about this for a second, what's going on is this here. So we first had an open chain. There's no funny things at the edges. There were these modules like here. A single sigma, let's say on the left end, brought us to sigma V modules. And then another sigma on the other end brought us to either one or psi. So we're looking at, you know, sigma times sigma equals one plus psi, clearly. So we see this famous fusion rule of the easing sector of the CFT happening in front of our eyes because we see our module, in a sense, split between these two different choices. So that's quite nice. So this really confirms that this very simple trick of blocking a double occupancy on a given spot is like a sigma defect. And we can now play with, you know, these sigma fields as we have them. So this is, you know, again, in the CFT, it looks like this. I marked these two states that come from sigma, sigma equals 1 plus psi. Yeah.
I know that
matches
the counting, but who really think this defect, they're introducing the binding, something that has a statistical.
I think, you know, it's the usual story that, you know, these easing sigmas, they bind the Majorana fermion. And since they, this is a critical theory, so if I put them at the ends, they're still, you know, overlap because this is all 1 over L. correlations, so I get a 1 over L type splitting between these two possible states. Okay, but now thanks for the question, because having understood what's going on in this manner, you can see coming what happens if I go off critical. I have this lambda. If I take it away from one, put it down towards zero, I break criticality, and I can anticipate now that this pair, which was 1 over L split at criticality, will actually collapse onto a degenerate bunch of ground states. So here we did that. So here is the same spectrum that we looked at before. And now I put this lambda and go down from 1 to 0. So all the states, you know, merge into these 0 lambda excitations. And you see there's a doublet now of these two ground states that I had from the one of sigma, sigma equals 1 plus psi. And they collapse on the same energy. So the energy difference is like lambda to the L. And since lambda is below 1, this is like, you know, e to the minus L. So you get a, you know, if you wish, a very nice qubit that's protected by supersymmetry, and that's coming from this CFT fusion rule, sigma sigma equals 1 plus psi. So this is all quite suggestive.
So a question even about the ground state. So before you create the excitation, so the degenerate ground states that you have there. So can you give a hint of what type of many body wave functions you have? So what is the state looking like?
Yeah. So if I stay over here, it's all CFT stuff. So critical states. It's you can't write them in a simple manner. But you know what we did. Maybe this helps your question. We followed these states. You know. Upon decreasing lambda, and we looked at very small lambda, where things become very simple. Okay, so and that's actually my next slide. So this we call extreme staggering. So this lambda, which staggers the site, if you make that, you know, 0, 1, 0, 1, 0, 1, you can actually write these states in closed form, essentially, where they're almost product states. So they have a product form where there's small groups, and the groups have a bit of entanglement between them, but for the rest, they're like product states. And so these are, you know, if you don't look at boundary conditions, there's three choices, which is the K plus one of this situation. And if you look at boundary conditions, if you do open chains, you can only fit one of these three patterns on the open chain, which is why you never see degeneracies. But with my sigma-sigma boundary conditions, I can actually put two at the same fermion number on the chain with the sigma-sigma boundary conditions. Okay? And then it turns out, you see, the two states that you saw collapsed onto the same one were actually these two states here. So the one of them sits at zero energy sharp. That's the protected state by supersymmetry. But the other guy comes exponentially close if I make lambda small. And so you see how this works. So you get this qubit at work as soon as you go off critical.
Can you remind us the definition of lambda?
Sure, that was quite a bit back up. So it was part of my definition. So you see, in defining my Q, I had the freedom to take all kinds of lambdas, which I could take site-dependent without breaking supersymmetry. And in the M2 model case that I'm now looking at, I do it like this here. So I put a lambda on every second site. And if I make lambda very small, I really stagger like 1, 0, 1, 0. So I'm kind of I'm blocking the supersymmetry away from all the even sites. And that's why I factor my state, so to say. And for the higher models, it's a bit more complicated, but there's a similar notion of this lambda. All right, all the way back.
If you do a Jordan Bigner transformation, is this simple kind of transistorizing model-ish or not?
We would like to be able to do that. You see, the whole thing, you know, smells a whole lot like topological order. Actually, there's another point coming to make that clear. But, you know, we're not, in the strict sense, 1D topological. We're not SPT, so to say. Because precisely, if you wish, you know, if you look at Kataev chain versus transverse Ising, we're on the transverse Ising side because we have, you know, we have a detectable order. Because my patterns over here, you see, somewhere in the middle of the chain, you can do a local measurement and decide which of the two you're looking at. Now, you know, if you insist that everything is supersymmetric, including your measuring choice, you cannot do that measurement, and you cannot see the difference. So within the supersymmetric universe, everything's protected, and it's like a topological qubit. But if you say, well, come on, be reasonable, let's just measure particle density and break supersymmetry in the measurement, then you can tell them apart, and it's not a topological state. And you know, if there would be a Jordan-Wigner-type transformation, it could go topological, and then I would have these edge Majoranas, and I would have edge Fibonacci's in a second. So that would be nice. Okay. So, but again, this is a bit technical, but if you look at the Moore-Reed quantum Hall phenomenology, just a second, and you do this thin torus notation, which is a way to organize all these Moore-Reed states, you can look at the actual topological Moore-Reed quantum bits, you know, which come from four segments on the sphere, where you fuse them two by two, and you get two channels. That's an actual topological qubit, the one that should actually make the 5-half state of quantum computer. And you can compare, you know, in Sintor's notation, these two states are really my two ground states in my 1D incarnation of the same system. But you know, but then again, in my case, this charge order of the Sintor's limit, which is an unphysical order in the quantum Hall case, in my case, it is a physical charge density wave order, which is why I'm not a topological guy at this stage. Sorry, that was a question.
Well, just to come back to the SPT story. So if you preserve the supersymmetric Hamiltonian, you can deform this into a trivial phase. Is there a symmetry that protects these edge states, for example?
Well, I would say the supersymmetry does that, right? Yeah.
So if you don't have that symmetry, then you can.
No. So that's a digital protected. For example, if you look at these degeneracies, these exponential degeneracies, if you fiddle with your chain, you know, somewhere by changing these lambdas in funny ways, as long as you keep Q squared equal to zero, you're not going to break this exponential degeneracy. So it is protected in a very non-trivial way. There's a whole bunch of perturbations which keep this property alive, but I have to do them supersymmetrically. Yeah. And if I stop doing that because I do an actual measurement of an actual particle density, I lose the property.
But this notion of measurement, I mean, if you just think about symmetries that are Hamiltonian, what do they protect? The ground state or not?
Yeah, no, that we certainly claim. So this magic exponential degeneracy is protected by the supersymmetry. And in a sense, you know, you expected this because these two states on the closed chain would be strictly degenerate at equals zero sharp due to the Witten index. Now, on the open chain, the Witten index no longer protects them, but there's this comparable thing of putting defects that does almost the same trick for you. And that's the new result that we have, because if you do simple open boundary conditions, you never see this. And okay, but let me try to get to my final point, which is the higher K case, which is kind of interesting. So, one more thing. So these defects, I told you, if you put them on the ends, they act like sigmas in the CFT, and they give these degeneracies. I could also move them into the bulk of the chain. And then they start being, you know, bulk defects, and I can do the same counting of ground states. And what you see, if you put a whole bunch of these bulk defects, you get many more of these exponentially suppressed energies, and you get a big quantum registers with a big dimension. And it turns out if you put n of these guys, your dimension is 2^(n/2), because they're easing sigma fields. So you see, you pick up the quantum dimension of these easing sigmas. So in a sense, you do have, you know, a very simple local little trick on your lattice model that really acts in a very honest way as an easing sigma field, and you can control lots of things here. Okay, and then, so again, this is all smells a whole lot like the paired case, like the Kataev chain, like the Mourid state. But the good thing of our situation is that we can easily go to k equal 3, 4, 5, etc. So here's a few things about k equal to 3. So now the CFT that's coming has these three parafermions. So there's three of these psi's, and there's the sigma fields, the spin fields, there's now three of them. They have this interesting fusion table coming all the way back from Fachayev-Samarodchikov. And, you know, again, for the quantum Hall experts, this is all built into this number 3 reaches Zayi state. That state uses this conformal field theory, and the excitations, the magical guys that give, you know, the famous Fibonacci braiding in reaches Zayi, are actually built using these sigmas as operators. So, you know, we were going after these same operators in our lattice models. So here's what you do. If we do the same analysis as before, you know, we have the supercharge which adds a particle. An extra site now means a hole of charge 3/5, because the whole thing is 3/5 filled. We would like to have the 1/5 charges, which are the Fibonacci guys. And how you do that is to actually put two types of defects. You know, the particles are now allowed up to three of them next to each other, because this is k equal to 3. But we can locally forbid either 3 or even 2 of them next to each other. This is the more severe constraint. This is the weakest. But they both do, you know, non-trivial things. And we tested the constraints again at the critical points by putting them on the ends of the open chain. And it's the same story. So now we can actually indeed conclude that what I call sigma 1 as a defect over here and over here, sigma 2, are the same guys that sit over here. Because in the CFT, we can label all the modules that we look at with these sigmas, and we can actually precisely check all these fusion rules. So for example, if you pick up one of them, you know, sigma 1 times sigma 2 is 1 plus epsilon. If you keep that in mind, now here's the CFT spectrum. This is the open system, boring system, 25 sites, I don't know how many particles, 40, 15, 16. And for example, here you see this is, I don't know, F equals 15 or so. So you see essentially a simple V module with no parafermion fields sitting there. Now I put these boundary conditions, let's say sigma 1 on the left side, sigma 2 on the right side. I follow my states in the spectrum and I match with the CFT once again. And now you see I double this module. So you see with the same spacing, I have now a substructure with 1 and epsilon. And this is precisely coming from sigma 1 times sigma 2 is 1 plus epsilon, because my defects are precisely, you know, injecting these parafermion spin fields, and they do their fusion rule as they should in CFT, and they produce these modules. And so now, you know, if you look where everything comes from, you can go to extreme staggering. There's now 4 ground states. They have, you know, a rather funny pattern that's very delicately connected to this choice of staggering that we learned from Hagedorf and Huysen, but it all works nicely. You can also, you can match with the kink formulation of these massive CFTs, these Chebyshev polynomials. That also works very nicely. All the masses of the kinks work out. And now you can, just to complete the story, you can actually look at these two types of defects and move them into the bulk of the 1D chain and start counting. So now you make big quantum registers, lots of exponentially suppressed energies. And if you look at how these vacua can connect over a defect, there's a funny pattern of how that works, which is pretty much the same as, let's say, in Sintor's Ritrosai counting. And if you now, for example, say I put n of these sigma 2 defects, I think, the degeneracy becomes a Fibonacci number. And you're really staring at, Fibonacci-anion quantum registers, be it in this non-topological setting in one dimension. So that's, the results. It's tantalizing. I'd like to this is what I showed you before as a summary. But let me give you this outlook sheet. So I stressed again that these MK models, they're not topologically strict 1D sense, unless you really believe everything around you is fully supersymmetric. Yet they show all these protected degeneracies that are very, very similar to what you get in non-abelian topological phases. And we have the controls of putting the sigmas where we want them to be and getting all the numbers as we like them to be. So that does all these questions. And one of them that I'm actually spending my time on here at Perimeter is this one here. So if we view this as a storage device for quantum information, we have all these knobs of putting sigmas and playing with things. Can we do some kind of protocol to act on this information? And can we mimic braiding of, let's say, the Fibonacci anions that could sit at the end? That will be my main goal. So I've been playing, last couple of days with doing these things, doing this 1D braiding, not by moving particles around, but by playing with coupling constants and activating topological and non-topological pieces of, let's say, a wire network. And it seems I can actually make a start on doing this. So I managed to actually braid two majoranas in this way, and I got the right result. So it's kind of promising, but also it's very much open to what extent this is a useful thing to explore any further, or if it's maybe too contrived to keep going. But I'm certainly giving this a bit of thought of how far we can get here. And I think that's, if anybody has ideas on any of these questions, please let me know, because I'd like to be fed with good ideas on this business. So final sheet is to thank all my Suzy friends and collaborators. These all people I worked with, and we in various combinations, we put out various papers. So I'm very grateful to all these people for all the joint work. And thanks for listening.
Can I see these MK theories when the Lambdasonic over 1 that are massive? So this K-index would classify the Suzy protected SPTs. Is that this? Can you see that way? Like, one symmetry and these are different instances, different phases.
Yeah, they would be. You see, I've been struggling with this. If you look on the internet, on the archive, I had an early version in this paper where I actually did call these things supersymmetric topological phases, and then I took that back because people said, you shouldn't call them this way. But in a sense, I mean, if there's a supergroup and there are projective representations with labeled by some k, that would be it, right? So somehow this k labels the non-equivalent choices of how many of these states can sit at the boundary, so to say. But again, I felt I had to be careful, so I'd rather not call them topological because I seem to be in contradiction with the usual definitions there. And but it's certainly the connection is too close to simply let go. That's also true.
You're saying that this first symmetry can only be viewed as a global symmetry protectiveness.
No, I guess people simply pointed out that what I also mentioned, that there is CDW order in my state, so I don't have the feature of indistinguishability against local measurements, which is, I guess, what you would need to be in a strictly topological situation.
But this person requires this order in some sense.
Yeah, again, that. I guess, you know, people don't call the transverse Ising model a topological phase, right? They would insist that you first do Jordan-Wiechner to go to Kitaev chain, and then it's the canonical setting. Although, for example, all these open chain spectres would be identical between the two formulations. You couldn't tell the difference. Same story for these para-Fentleyons, you know, these Fentley chains. They play with two formulations, and they typically tend to do their analysis on the ordered state because it's easier. But there they do have the option of doing the Jordan-Wiechner in generalized form to go through topological formulation.
A question about M1 model on trend orbits.
Yes.
So is there anything interesting about the dynamics? So for example, if I want to know how local operators couple different ground states. So let's say if I slightly perturb the model, right, with some local operators, would they either connect different ground states or would there be something less about dynamics?
We don't know too much. What I strongly believe is that, you know, these defects, you can certainly also imagine putting on these 2D cases. And, you know, you can play with, you know, phasing in one defect and then putting it in a different spot and doing braiding protocols, etc. And I'm quite sure doing that kind of trick, you are going to connect your various ground states. I'm not sure about local operators. You see, if there's clearly the square lattice case has this. You see, I told you there are these tilings that are one-on-one with the ground states. But clearly, since, you know, the entropy is only going with the perimeter, not with the area, that's because if you want to do a tiling with these green and red guys, if you start with the edges, then it's already fixed. So if you tile your left edge and your lower edge, then the whole thing is completely fixed. So there are no local moves in those tilings. But in triangular case, there should be local moves to account for the expansion degeneracy there. And there could be operators that implement those moves. So it's all, I think it's possible to play with these things even on rather small systems. So it's not completely out of reach of some further analysis.
About those 2D models, do you know what those states, ground states, look like in the real space?
No. We're not sure about gaps. I think that there is a small conjecture. So let's see where this result. So you see there this result here, which is an exact result, typically tells you that between the number of ground states of the quantum problem and the number of tilings, there's a small correction term. And so in cases where this is positive, we believe that, you know, everybody will be gapped away from this ground state manifold, except for probably these guys here, which could be on their way and actually sit at one of L-type energies. But we don't know too much. You know, we looked at ladders for, let's say, square ladder or comparable things. We found critical modes in the ladders. So we believe there's things running around the edges. But then, you know, you could say it looks like 2D topological because it's a torus and there's lots of ground state degeneracies. But in a sense, it's too much, right? Because it seems that if you like, you know, usually in topological order, if let's say around one direction of the torus, you do a cycle, you know, you go, let's say you switch between, let's say, four ground states for toric code or so. And here there's a similar switching of ground states, but it depends on where you do it, which is why you get 2^3 n+m, right? So it's more structured than the normal case, but it has some analogies. And again, we haven't been able to completely phrase this in a satisfactory manner.
Counting. For instance, if you think about quantum compass model, if
final square that is, you can construct, let's say you have n rows, you can, for each row, you can construct an integral motion. So that tells you that the ground state has to be generated 2 to the power of n. So I was just wondering if there's something similar here that you can construct some of the local, say, integral motion.
We don't know. It's really open. I mean, there is another 2D model that we played this, which is similar in the sense of the counting, but much simpler to analyze, is this what we call the bathroom tilings. So there's octagons and squares, you know, if you have them in your bathroom. So that also has 2 to the n plus m ground states, but in a much easier fashion. So that would be a place to start. Like, yeah, in my paper, I suggest to look at that and play with defects, because there it's quite a bit easier than this 2D square. 2D square is very cumbersome.
Okay. So if there are no more questions, let's say we can power again.